Well, I guess we all have stories to tell, and sometimes stretching the truth a little makes those stories so much more engaging. The writer of fiction is supposed to be creative, but what about the writer of non-fiction? Non-fiction aspires to tell the truth. So what's the role of creativity when you're in the non-fiction game? Robin Hemley knows a thing or two about creative non-fiction. He's written 8 books of fiction and non-fiction, including the very funny semi-autobiographical novel Do Over. And since 2004, he's been directing the non-fiction writing program at the University of Iowa in the US. And he's a guest at this year's Melbourne Writers Festival, and he joins me now. Welcome, Robin.
Hi.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of talk about creative non-fiction. What do you make of that term?
Well, I'm not a great fan of the term, actually. I tend to like to break down the term into subgenres, like the essay, memoir, and so on, because we don't talk about creative fiction. We don't talk about creative poetry. We know, for instance, when we're talking about poetry, usually that we're not talking about, say, the limerick. We're talking about something literary. And I think when the term first came up, creative nonfiction, it was useful because fiction and poetry sort of had the high ground in academia. They were considered artful, but nonfiction wasn't. Mm. So the term was useful for a time, but now I think maybe we're past it.
I'm glad you've said that, because I want the way people write history, or even news, actually, to be in some sense creative.
Right.
I don't mean I want them to make it up, like in creative accounting, but I do want the way in which they encounter the truth to be imaginative and oblique and arresting.
Right. I just had some visitors in the States from France, some friends of ours, and they were talking about the bookstores there, how they don't break things into quite the same kind of units that maybe we do in the States and in Australia. So you just have literature and you have poetry, and then there's essay. But they talk about essay as a kind of philosophical discourse. But I like the idea of just putting short stories and memoir and all of that in the literature category and not trying to parse it quite so finely as we sometimes do.
Still, I suppose I want to know when I'm reading a memoir whether this person is telling me a story that is based in their actual experience or whether they're making stuff up. And I do get cheesed off when I read a book that purports to be truthful and later discover that actually it wasn't.
But I think every book that you read that purports to be truthful is distorting something, because if I do an exercise with my students, for instance, where I have them just close their eyes and describe the room that they're sitting in, and they always distort things. I think that every time you put something down on paper or on the computer, there's inevitable distortion. You know, when you read a memoir where someone's writing about their childhood or even something that happened 5 years ago and they write down a conversation, it's definitely a recreation.
Sure, but a novel that purports to take you into the mindset of a man who's, let's say, been in the trenches in the First World War is different to me from the diary of a man who's been in the trenches in the First World War. I do want to know that one of them is a man wrestling to tell you what he actually went through.
Right. I mean, I think that you don't want to completely fabricate something that you saying that you experienced something that you didn't experience at all and trying to pass that off. I think that's a human failing. And not only memoirists do that, but journalists have been caught doing that as well.
Well, we all do it in our everyday life,
yeah,
too, don't we?
Yeah.
We all incorporate stories that something perhaps that happened to our wife that suddenly becomes a story we tell as though we were there ourselves. Or I guess we all do it.
Yeah.
It's just that once you go into print, I think you should be more conscientious about what you fib about.
Right. Well, it's true. It's true. It's just that sometimes we have agendas that we're not even aware of when we're trying to purportedly tell the truth. I did a story that took me 5 years about a purported anthropological hoax in the Philippines about this group called the Tasadai tribe. And there was one side that believed they were definitely a hoax and one side that believed they were definitely authentic. And I went to visit this tribe with both sides and had radically different experiences. So my perception of what the facts were almost like that Kurosawa film Rashomon. You know, you have this sort of, you look at some of the facts one way and you see it radically different if you look at it slightly differently.
Mm. I'm open to what you're saying, Robin, but there's a part of me that resists what you're saying too. Because there's a part of me that says, you're so close to saying, since factual stories and fictional stories are so alike, you may as well just make it all up. In the end, it seems to me that if someone is reaching for the truth, however incompletely they tell it, that is a different kind of enterprise from saying, let me take you on the ride of your life. It's going to be a fantasy voyage into the extremes of, you know, what the human mind can imagine.
Right, right. No, I'm not saying at all, actually, that you should just say, well, let's just make things up. I'm just saying that the reader has to be skeptical too, and that the reader, you should approach everything that you're reading with some degree of skepticism. If someone says, you know, this is true, then, you know, you should take it with a grain of salt. I actually teach a course at the University of Iowa that's a lot of fun. It's the history of the fake memoir. And we've been dealing with these fake memoirs for actually hundreds of years. And I like to actually look at them as kind of cultural artifacts and say, well, what does it say about us that we're so that we want to believe so passionately in someone like James Fry, you know, the Million Little Pieces guy who Oprah excoriated. And, you know, what does that say about us in our sort of cultural moment? So I'm less interested in the person who's perpetrating the fraud and more interested in why the fraud is successful.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. And my guest is Robin Hemley, a writer who's at the Melbourne Writers Festival. And he teaches at the University of Iowa. He runs a course there on nonfiction writing. And we're exploring that blurry boundary between fiction and nonfiction. And you were saying that you're writing, that you've taught this history on the fake memoir. I suppose the fake memoir that attracted a lot of attention recently was Norma Khoury's Forbidden Love, about which there was a scandal because she claimed that it was the true story of her best friend in Jordan. And it involved an honour killing, didn't it? That was the kind of central event. And it turned out that this is not what had happened at all.
Right.
Now, where did you stand on that?
Well, I think that the people who write these types of memoirs, Norma Khoury and James Fry and others, it's a kind of self-aggrandizement, you know, that they're trying to present themselves in this light that's going to sell books and to make themselves into heroes or victims or whatever. And, of course, that's a human failing, and I don't condone it, but I'm interested in it all the same, almost in a kind of anthropological way, I suppose.
You're interested in why we are so willing to accept or to endow them with truth.
Right, because someone like James Fry, which I know that book a lot better than Norma Khoury's, James Fry's book.
You know, I don't know about the James Fry book, so can you just fill us in on that?
Okay, so that was a book that where James Fry said he'd been through this, it was a sort of redemption story, a misery memoir about being addicted to drugs and alcohol and having his girlfriend commit suicide. And it turned out he didn't have a girlfriend who committed suicide. Instead of being in prison for 6 months, he'd been in the drunk tank for 3 hours. And so he was on the Oprah Winfrey show, and she bought everything he said, hook, line, and sinker, and then it was revealed later that it was a fraud, much like the Norma Khoury kind of episode. And so in that case, you know, he was just trying to be self-aggrandizing, basically. And I find stories like that really fascinating. When he wrote that, he wanted to write it as a novel first. And then someone told him, whether it's his agent or whoever, said, well, this would be much better as a memoir. So he tried to pass it off as a memoir. And my feeling is that a second-rate novel shouldn't make a first-rate memoir. And that if the only thing that interests us about the book is its scrim of authenticity, then it can't be a very good book. And we have to be a lot more skeptical as readers and say, well, what is the... Why are we reading this book? Are we only reading it for this sort of prurient pleasure of seeing someone's the sort of under seams of someone's tawdry life? You know, what is it that we're really after when we're reading these books?
I find myself interested, you know, in the other side of the equation. That is, what makes people do this? Only because I interview writers.
Sure.
And every now and then I interview a writer and I think, you're a fabulist. I mean, you have no idea what's true and what's not.
Right.
And it's very hard to challenge someone on that. But in my own mind, I sometimes think, gee, I don't know whether I believe you about anything.
Right.
Have you ever encountered someone like that?
Of course. I encounter them all the time, and they're not only writers, you know. I encounter people, you know, who like to make up things and pass them off as true. But I do think, I mean, of course there's a difference between fiction and nonfiction, but a lot of it's in the terms of the form, you know, what a short story does as opposed to what an essay does. And so I'm interested, yeah, I'm definitely interested in the mind of the writer who tries to fabricate and pass that off, but I'm also interested in the audience.
Now, you've got a new collection of stories. It's called Reply All, and it includes a story that fits into the discussion we're having, actually. It's called Magellan's Stew. Perhaps you could outline its premise for us.
Well, it's a sort of fabulous story about a person who's on Magellan's voyage around the world, and he's a Portuguese spy on the ship. And as you know, Magellan was killed in the Philippines by the warrior Lapu-Lapu on his voyage. And I just imagined that there was this Portuguese spy on board who wanted Magellan dead, and so mistranslated everything that Lapu-Lapu was telling him, so that he causes this war between the two sides. Because I'm really interested in the way people misinterpret each other, and especially cultural clashes like that. So I had a lot of fun with it. It was a really fun story.
It's a wonderfully vivid story. I mean, it's a very compelling story and very believable story. So what do you want us to take away from it? I mean, are you saying to us that this story you've told of how Magellan was killed, that purports to be about how Magellan was killed on that particular day, wading into the water, weighed down by armor, to confront warriors whom he couldn't possibly defeat because they were actually fighting people, and he just had his sort of cooks and whatnot around him, you know, waving weapons. Are you claiming that you can actually illuminate that historical event by some kind of act of imaginative empathy, or are you saying, this is just like describing a battle? If it was star fiction and it was the Empire fleet facing the Federation fleet and firing across space.
Well, it's a kind of maybe a radical reinterpretation of history, I'd say, that it's using I mean, in fiction, I research often as hard as I research in nonfiction. And so I did a lot of research on Magellan and on that battle and tried to make it as believable as possible, but I was really interested in the characters and in who Magellan wanted to be and who he purported to be, and on sort of his arrogance in some ways, and then I was really interested in this character I completely made up of the interpreter and what he wanted.
So, is it fair to say that you're writing fiction in order to reveal a truth that is beyond the reach of history, because we don't actually have the data? But given what we know, it might well have unfolded like this.
Yes, but notice, even though I pretend it's a diary that was found in some library in Indiana, I mean, I make it this very fabulous kind of unlikely scenario. But imagine if I had said, well, this put this as nonfiction and said this was really true. I mean, then I'd be guilty of that kind of thing that we've been talking
about.
It'd
be like faking the Hitler diaries.
Exactly. And I definitely wouldn't. I know the difference between the two. And so I write fiction and I write nonfiction. But I find it really interesting sometimes when the lines blur a bit, you know. And so when you write historical fiction, you're putting in things that are largely true, but there's a certain aspect of the imagination that's inevitable.
In some way, every story in this book, Reply All, is about the ways people play with the truth or to see themselves, isn't it? I mean, the opening story is about a son who claims to have a gift for identifying saints or the relics of saints. So he lives with – well, tell us the story.
Well, this one came about when I was in Europe, and someone told me that there had been a big trade in the Middle Ages in saints' relics and bones, and many more bones were sold, purporting to be, you know, Saint Bartholomew or whoever, than actually could possibly be the case. And so I imagined this man and his son living outside of Chinon in France, where Joan of Arc presented herself to the Dauphin, and doing this lively trade in saints' bones. And the father believes that they really are saints' bones, but the son is actually a lot more cynical and has been robbing graves to supply them.
He knows what's what.
He does.
He can tell a fake diary from a real one. Poor old dad has no idea what's going on.
It's told from the father's point of view, and he only finds out later that his son's been doing
he
this.
He does, yeah. Can I just take you back now to a book called Do Over, which you published in 2009, in which you revisit 10 embarrassing childhood experiences that continue to haunt you into adult life. Perhaps you could just tell us about those and why you wrote about them.
Well, that was probably the most fun I've ever had writing a book. I was brainstorming ideas with some of my graduate students one day, and for some reason it just popped into my mind, wouldn't it be fun if I went back to summer camp as an adult and bunked with a bunch of 10-year-olds and had the chance now to finally prove myself beating them at basketball and football and things like that. When I was 10, I was a pretty poor physical specimen. I thought, well, I could, you know, maybe be better now. And so my students thought it was a fun idea, and I approached New York Magazine, and they liked the idea as well. And so I went back to my summer camp for a week and was lorded over by a bunch of 18-year-old counselors and ate terrible camp food and played all those sports, and the 10-year-old still beat me in all the sports. And I wrote this article called Big Man on Camp, and it was a lot of fun. And I decided, well, it would be fun to revisit all the sites of childhood embarrassment and try to sort of have a second shot at them, a second chance at them. So one of the things I did was to go back to school prom, and there was a woman I'd had a crush on when I was 16 and was too shy to ask her out to the prom. So I called her up and said, I called her up and said, will you go to the prom with me? And she said, well, you know, let me ask my husband. And it worked out. So we went to the prom, and
didn't get your father to drive her around to her house, did you, and pick her up at the front door?
No. There were modifications to the whole thing. We didn't even have a kiss or anything. It was all, because we were both married, and but it was a lot of fun. And I was also in a play when I was 7 years old called The Littlest Angel, and I was the heavenly messenger, and all I had to do was deliver a box of earthly goods to the kid playing the Littlest Angel. And I got out on stage and I just froze completely, and I didn't know what to do, so I just threw the box at him and said, here's your stupid box, and ran off stage. And I found a group in Georgia putting on the play again, and they let me reprise my role as the heavenly messenger. So I did about 10 of these.
And you didn't ad lib?
I didn't ad lib, no. When I was 7, I was too mortified to do anything but run off stage. But when I was 48, I delivered my lines professionally.
And did you do it because you knew it would be fun, or did you do it because you thought it would generate interesting writing, or was there a therapeutic motive here?
Actually, all three. I mean, I knew it would be fun. I knew it would be embarrassing. And one of the things that we do in writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is create conflict and create tension. And I knew that it would create a kind of comic tension that I wanted to explore. And there was a therapeutic aspect as well. I mean, I knew I wouldn't change the past. You can't do that. But what it did was give me a different perspective on the past. Certain things that I have remembered one way, sort of confronting them and even some of the people I had known in the past and hadn't seen for a long time made me change my mind.
Where did you get the idea to do this?
I mean, it was just from basically just wanting to go back to summer camp and try that again, just try it one more time.
Now, you'll be back in Australia later in the year for a conference on nonfiction at RMIT in Melbourne. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is a conference that I founded in 2005 at the University of Iowa called Nonfiction Now, and it's a gathering of about 400 writers from around the world, a three-day conversation about nonfiction, where it's going, where it's been, it's been wonderful. We've had three iterations of it over the years. It's every other year. And the last time in 2010, I brought some writers from Australia over, and Iowa City and Melbourne are both UNESCO Cities of World Literature, and so I decided, well, let's bring some writers from Melbourne over. So I did, and it was so successful that I thought, well, let's have the next one in Melbourne, and I think it's going to be great. We have writers from all over the world, from Iceland, from Alaska, obviously a large Australian contingent, the Philippines, and we've got four great keynoters, Helen Garner, David Shields, author of Reality Hunger, Margot Jefferson, who won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism, and Jose Dalasay, who's a well-known writer from the Philippines.
Well, that does sound engaging. Perhaps we can catch up with you again in November.
That would be great. I'd love it.
Thank you for coming in and telling us about what you're doing at the moment. And people who want to catch up with you can find you at the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for having me.
Robin Hemley. His new book of short stories is called Reply All. It's published by Indiana University Press. Do you have an Australian publisher?
Not at the moment.
So that's who it's published by, Indiana University Press. And as I say, Robin is a guest of the Melbourne Writers Festival. And we've got links to his books on our website. This is Books and Arts Daily.